Hey, this is Ryan Thomas. Thanks so much for listening to On the Road and supporting Faith Radio. You are just the very best, and we appreciate you so much. Enjoy the show.
Discovering stories of courage, determination, and hope. Welcome to Faith Radio's On the Road. Now, here's Ryan Thomas.
Life is short. I want to live it well. One life, one story to tell. Life is short. I want to live it well. And you're the one I'm living for.
From a young boy carefully aiming and tossing rocks at the clothespins on his mom's clothesline, he developed into a Cy Young Award winning all-star major league pitcher with one of the most dazzling curveballs you'll ever see. And Barry Zito says even the very heights of success didn't fill what he calls the hole in his heart. In fact, those very heights created what was at times an unbearable burden. Today we'll meet the man and discover what and who he found that changed everything. His new book is out this week, Curveball: How I Discovered True Fulfillment After Chasing Fame and Fortune. And Mr. Barry Zito joins us today on the road. What a treat to talk to you, sir. I know it's been a ridiculously full week for you, so quite sincerely, thank you so much for the time today, Barry.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Having a great time, and thanks for having me on, Ryan.
Well, absolutely. Barry, can I just say congrats on the book? My endorsement would simply be that it's so good and just so relatably open. It made this Minnesota Twins fan not only forgive you for kicking us out of the playoffs in 2006, but become quite a fan of yours along the way.
Oh, well, I appreciate it. Yeah, those Minnesota games are near and dear to my heart, especially 06, because I got to pitch game one of that series against Johan, and of course he was an all-time legend, man.
Oh, I remember it very well, sir. I was in the front row of the Metrodome. We had such high hopes, and then here comes Barry Zito in that curveball, and we just can't hit anything, really.
Oh, man, that was really great.
Well, you paint the picture of five-year-old Barry knocking clothespins off your mom's wash line in the backyard by throwing rocks at them. Take us just a little bit inside how you discovered a love for the game of baseball.
Yeah, I was born in Vegas, actually, and my father was, you know, a great jazz musician in his time, but ended up being a talent manager in Vegas, and that's when I came along in 1978. So we actually moved to San Diego in 1984 so that my mother could go be a pastor in the New Age Spiritual Center that her mother had actually founded. And so that was really the first time I ever tried sports, and certainly baseball was the one I gravitated to, and it all started, like you said, throwing rocks at clothespins that were hanging on the clothesline in the backyard.
You really set the stage for the rest of the story when you talk about how you came to share your parents' view of who you were growing up. And, you know, on one level, it sounds pretty great at first, because you explained they taught you to believe you were this uniquely talented and special person, which clearly you are, but it was, in a sense, a worldview where it simply was all about you, right? Is that a fair way to look at what was missing?
That's right. And in the book, it might sound a little harsh, I guess, on my parents. And it's not to say they didn't have great intentions and didn't love me. So, I mean, they loved me so well, and just an incredible childhood that I had. And, but I think the thing where, you know, I interpreted it wrong, or they did it wrong, I'm not sure, was thinking that I was more special and kind of that golden child, so to speak. Even my older sisters would refer to me as like the golden child, because, you know, my father and mother gave me so much attention. And, you know, I was about 10 years younger than my two siblings. And it just gave me this identity that I was, in a lot of ways, you know, better than other people. And of course, that was just operating under the surface. I didn't outwardly think that, but it was not a good way to start.
Well, anyone who saw you pitch is going to be thinking about one quite specific item in your arsenal, which was that thoroughly nasty breaking curveball. When did you discover the curve, sir? How did it come about?
The curve was actually, you know, my father had always put these baseball books in front of me. And again, being a talent manager, he knew how to develop talent, although he didn't really know a thing about sports. So he would purchase these books, and one of them was The Art of Pitching by Tom Seaver. And there was all different pictures of grips, you know, fastballs and changeups and sliders. Mm-hmm. And so I just gripped the baseball like the picture, you know, it was a curveball. And I started throwing that when I was seven. And it came very naturally to me, and that kind of became my signature pitch even at the age of 7 years old.
That's kind of hilarious. How many kids probably tried to imitate, you know, the grip in that textbook, and yet here you are. You did it just a little bit better than the rest of us, Barry.
Yeah, and that is something that, you know, I really have no clue how any of that stuff worked or happened, you know, but when I was in it, and certainly before I became a believer, you know, I was taking credit for everything in my life. And, you know, I even remember a woman coming up to me in early in my career saying, "You must feel so blessed for that curveball you throw. Wow, it's just so great." And I got upset with her and actually was getting defensive, saying, "You have no idea how hard I'm working and how hard I've worked since I was seven. How can you say that?" I mean, I was literally offended that I didn't get all the credit. And I kind of tie that back to really my worldview growing up.
That's a really interesting window inside. We're talking with Barry Zito today on the road, the Cy Young Award winning all-star former pitcher in Major League Baseball. He has authored Curveball, How I Discovered True Fulfillment After Chasing Fame and Fortune, just out this week from W Books. So you referenced it just a bit there in the previous answer, but as you start to really pursue this baseball dream, your relationship with your dad is pivotal. And you write that he was a talent agent, but as your promise becomes clearer and clearer, you really become his only client. Can you kind of take us inside that relationship?
Yeah, and this isn't something I realized until I was actually writing the book in these last couple of years. But because I always knew my father was this brilliant jazz musician, and you know, he was a road conductor for Nat King Cole, and my mother was also a singer with Nat, and that's where they met. And so I always saw him as a musician. And it wasn't until literally 4 or 5 years ago, we went to Vegas, my sister and I, and we met with some of his old clients. And they talked about how he was incredible for, you know, realizing what somebody had to do to be successful. And so now, you know, he was 50 when he had me. And of course, I was 7, 8 years old playing baseball. And he was with me in the backyard 2 hours a day. You know, he didn't work at that point. So, you know, we were in the backyard every day for almost 12 years, you know, from 6 to 18, really. And he was just developing that talent and planting those seeds that, you know, if I keep working hard, I can be a great champion and, you know, have all the money that I would ever want and be famous and these things. And of course, I didn't really know about all that other stuff. Of course, I just wanted to pitch in the major leagues like most kids.
Well, to take that a step further, you talk about the goals that he set for you. How many Cy Young Awards you'd win, which I believe was more than Greg Maddux and Sandy Koufax put together. How many how many games you were going to win? And were you really feeling that burden of expectations? I mean, even far before you reached the major leagues.
I did, you know, and I interpreted his love and approval really as performance-based. If I could pitch well, then he would approve of me, you know, but if I didn't pitch well, he would kind of shake his head and whisper, you know, "Hey, we got work to do. Let's get back there." And so, you know, and my mom the whole time was like, "Joe, it's fine. You know, if he loses, that's okay. Like, we just want him to be happy and okay with himself." And, but again, my father was overcoming his own self-worth issues, which I go into a little bit in the book of how he was a product of rape. And how his father actually had raped a 14-year-old girl, a stepdaughter, and my father was the product of that. And so when I tie it back to his self-worth history, it kind of makes sense that he was really overcompensating and pushing me into this fame and this glory of, you know, all these things for, you know, maybe his own desires too.
Yeah, it is just such a thoroughly honest and raw book. It really will draw you in and just, it makes you really relate to so many things. Now, not many of us, of course, will experience many of the things that Barry has, but there's just so much that is relatable in the book. You become this much-heralded first-round prospect. It's a quick tour of duty, really quick, in the minor leagues. And then your first taste of Major League Baseball. You've climbed that mountain. You're in this massive stadium. Is that feeling of running out there on that field what you anticipated, or was it different in any way?
No, that first game and really my first, you know, my first year, couple years was incredible. I mean, it was just that rush of being in the major leagues, you know, pitching against guys I'd watched my whole life, collected their baseball cards, you know, it was surreal. And I was really just operating on the ignorance is bliss concept, you know, going out there and I don't really know what I'm up against. I'm just doing what I do. And, you know, it was a incredible and so fun. And, you know, that first game specifically, you know, I just remember it like it was yesterday. And, you know, I got that first win. And like you said, my father had always told me 300 wins. This is what we are shooting for. And I put emphasis on we, because my father always referred to us as we, even when I was out on the mound at times, you know, when we are on the mound. And then of course my father would say, you know, Joe, you're not on the mound, Barry's on the mound. But after that first win, I remember thinking to myself, one down, 299 to go. And I mean, it was that intense, that drive for the 300. And, you know, of course I barely even got halfway there.
Wow. Barry Zito joins us today. Cy Young Award winning all-star former pitcher in Major League Baseball. He's authored Curveball, How I Discovered True Fulfillment After Chasing Fame and Fortune. It is just available wherever fine books are sold from W Books this week. So you have this run from 2000 to 2007 in Oakland where you're just a force of nature, really. I mean, you win the Cy Young Award. You and your friends, Mark Mulder and Tim Hudson, are billed as the successors to Maddox, Glavine, and Smoltz. But one of the interesting things about that time is that it's pretty clear from what you write and how you talk about that time that you're still looking for something else, that you're still searching for something that's more, right? Can you explain what that was like?
Absolutely. So, you know, for me growing up was under the idea of, you know, if I can believe this enough, if I can, you know, have my willpower control my mind enough to not focus on anything negative and stay fixated on what I want to achieve or what my circumstances, you know, should be, then I can and will create that. And so that idea of the manifestation, right? And a lot of manifesting talk is around the world today and in this country, right? I'm going to manifest my reality. Yeah. I was convinced that I could manifest the success and of course was having great success early in life. So that was like, okay, I did it. I'm manifesting. And so what would happen though, is when I would have some bad games, I was like, okay, I must not be manifesting correctly. Mm. So I would then go to the Barnes and Noble self-help section and start scanning that and buy a book or two. And that would become kind of my religion or my spirituality for the next number of weeks until my next bad game. And then I would switch again. And I ended up testing or trying, you know, multiple religions and spiritual practices over the years in Oakland, trying to find that one that would lead to a good game every time. And it was exhausting, I mean, to say the least.
Well, after Oakland's playoff run in 2006, you sign what at that point is the biggest contract ever given to any pitcher ever with the Giants just across the bay. And your new general manager says, Barry, you may as well tattoo the number 126 million on your forehead. What changed when you made the move to San Francisco?
Yeah, so, you know, in Oakland, Oakland and San Francisco are pretty close to each other, but San Francisco is kind of the, you know, the high market team. They spend all the money on payroll, whereas the Oakland A's were, you know, the money ball and always getting bargain players and still winning somehow. So for me, I kind of felt like I couldn't be that carefree, loose, kind of eccentric yoga kid in San Francisco. And so I think for me, I kind of put the pressure on myself to be more professional, more, you know, like a true baseball player or more confident even. And of course, all the pressure from the contract made me feel like I had to justify that number, you know, every 5 days on the mound. And it almost felt like if I did anything short of a complete game shutout, then I was failing.
Of course.
And I ended up becoming just incredibly obsessed with getting, you know, opinions on my side and appealing to everybody in the stand so that they would like me and felt I was worth it.
Man, possibly the most heart-wrenching conversation that you detail is the one you really open the book with. When your Giants manager, Bruce Bochy, tells you going to the playoffs in 2010 that you won't be on the team's playoff roster, and you've set the scene for what that did to you by sharing there were times when you could be found in your SUV with sunglasses covering your eyes and literally weeping at where life had taken you. I was so moved by that description. Can you just give us a sense of just how painful that was and how much you even hated coming to the park at that point, like you've talked about?
Yeah, I mean, because I was trying to win my father's approval for, you know, my childhood in a lot of ways, I ended up trying to win the fans' approval. And if I wasn't pitching well, I wouldn't leave my home until I had to go to the field. And then when I went to the field, I'd cover up with sunglasses and headphones and try to be essentially just invisible. Because here I was there, you know, multi-million dollar guy that they wanted me to lead them to the promised land of the World Series. And, you know, I couldn't get anybody out. And so I would just try to hide not only from everybody else, but from myself. I mean, it was misery and shame and, you know, in my car or even going back to this huge mansion I bought in the, you know, these beautiful mountains up north of San Francisco, but just alone and completely miserable and doing whatever I could to escape myself.
A lot of the headlines about the book this week have come really at this point in the story when you've admitted that later that year, because of exactly the emotions you describe, you actually find yourself inwardly cheering against your teammates as they go on that World Series run.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, that October of 2010 was terrible. And like you asked before, you know, I came home after my coach told me I couldn't be on the roster and, you know, that I was going to be in the dugout watching the team play, obviously without being able to do it. And so I came home and I said, Dad, I think I might want to quit baseball. And if I do, will you still love me? And I didn't know the answer to that question. And of course, you know, well, he said, that's not a great business decision, but of course I would. And It almost confirmed a suspicion possibly. And of course I'll never know, but I know he loved me. I do. And in that kind of vulnerable state I was in, that's not what I wanted to hear.
No.
And, I ended up going to the field every day, watching my team play in the playoffs. And there was that part of me that wanted them to lose to prove that I was still needed on my team. Cause you know, at that point I didn't even feel like they were my team anymore.
We are just about to the point in this story when things really start to change, but just one more point before we get there. When success really was tougher to come by on the field, you started to see if just maybe fame and famous friends and high-profile relationships will possibly fill that void, but you say they really didn't do the trick either.
No, I mean, I was scratching and clawing for, you know, fulfillment, for contentment and satisfaction. And I couldn't get it on the field. So then I turned to other places. And at the time I'd been living in West Hollywood and had a big fancy house up on the top of the hill there in the Hollywood Hills and, you know, had bought multiple sports cars and fancy suits and was, you know, chasing, you know, girls around Hollywood, trying to validate myself as being important and going, trying to hang out with famous people and, really just trying to be relevant in any way I could.
Sure.
To uphold this kind of, you know, plummeting reputation and sense of self that was happening.
Well, it's one of the most incredible stories you'll ever hear. Barry Zito is with us today, the Cy Young Award winning all-star former pitcher in Major League Baseball, the author of the book Curveball, How I Discovered True Fulfillment After Chasing Fame and Fortune, just out this week from W Books and available wherever fine books are sold. So this is the fun part. You point to two moments that really start to change everything. One is a 12-step fellowship program that tackles codependency. The other is when your wife hands you a Bible. What was the timeline there, Barry? Which one came first?
Yeah, so my team ended up winning that World Series in 2010, and you know, I had to get on the cable car for the big famous parade, you know, through the San Francisco streets and watching people, you know, yell every F-bomb and expletive they could at my face, essentially, as this cable car is going through. So that was a destructive moment in my life. But also, I'm grateful because that was when everything completely crumbled. So I got back to L.A. and checked myself into this 12-step, which, you know, was essentially being obsessed with what other people think. And step one was, you know, my life's become unmanageable and I'm powerless over other people's opinions. And that was a big step for me to admit that I'm powerless over other people's opinions. I, you know, being a kid that could control circumstance growing up, it was hard to say that until that moment. And then, of course, step two is willing to admit there's a power greater than me that could restore me my sanity. And that was something that I had never felt or admitted. And in a lot of ways, that would be a sign of weakness, saying there's anything greater than me. So that was like the seed that was planted. And then, you know, having been with my wife, Amber, you know, in those dating stages that year, hearing her pray to a father that sounded, that was loving and that, you know, kind of cared about her almost as a child would. And that was something so new to me. I'd only prayed to a force, you know, an impersonal force that would hopefully listen to my thought and deliver this circumstance for my selfish need. It was
sure.
quite different. She would pray for me and for others, and I never prayed for anybody other than myself to this force. So those were two things that really changed it all. And when she eventually handed me that Bible, you know, about 8 months later, after seeing me in a sea of my self-help books, that is truly when the change happened.
It's just a beautiful discovery. And you've laid out that for so long and really throughout, woven into this story, you've been searching for that missing piece, that whatever it was that would make your heart whole. And when you found Jesus, you stopped searching. How did you know that that he was it?
Yeah, that's a great question. So after my wife hands me the Bible, I start going to Bible study at the Giants. You know, the Giants had a Bible study once a week, and me and a couple other players were in it. And about 3 months later, you know, I prayed the prayer with our chaplain, and something was different, because I had, of course, tried so many religions and spiritualities, and then would just move on to the next one after, you know, I had some tough times. But with Jesus, it was different. It was the first time I felt approved of and loved and validated and all those things I searched for in the world, but without actually earning them, without working for them, without having to perform for them. And that was the change. And so I learned about grace. You know, I learned about what it meant to have something that I actually don't deserve. And, you know, I got to see baseball for what it really was, which was a game that it was an honor to even play it at that level versus something that I was entitled to because I'd worked so hard for it.
That's one of my favorite parts of the book too, because you even play a little bit more minor league baseball than later on. And you talk about just how much fun you had, that you really just rediscovered the same love for baseball that you had when you were out there throwing the rocks at the clothespins.
Exactly. I mean, you know, and I think life can be so, we can feel so liberated when we stop applying pressure to all the things in our world to validate us and to, you know, to make us happy and to fulfill us. I mean, that's putting a lot of pressure on baseball, on relationships, on, you know, on our friends, on whatever it is. And to be seeking that in the world it's the wrong place. We're never going to get it. You know, we might get a few seconds or a few days or weeks of a spike in that, you know, but eventually we're back to baseline. And that's what I learned. I could not find it on the horizontal plane.
Well, there it is. The story of Barry Zito, who's been with us today. The book, which is just out from W Books, is called Curveball: How I Discovered True Fulfillment After Chasing Fame and Fortune. And it is available wherever fine books are sold, and you can find it on all the online retailers. Barry, if people want to find out more about you and follow your career and these great messages that you have, you also, of course, are a talented musician as well. I heard you sing this morning on the Dan Patrick Show and play your guitar, and you sound very good, sir. Well done, first of all.
Oh, thanks, man. You know, that my father and mother musical, and it's been so fun to go into music full time in Nashville. So I'm writing songs out there and, you know, learning music production and just having a great time being creative. And I was able to release a little EP and really tell some of the stories that I tell in the book, you know, but having them set to music. And that was really enjoyable.
It sounds great. As Dan Patrick pointed out this morning, there's a country twang to your voice that might surprise people for the California boy, but it sounds really good. If people want to find out more about you and follow you on the social media sites, sir, where should they go?
Yeah, Barry Zito Music on socials, and BarryZitoMusic.com is the website. And I play shows, you know, here and there across the country. And we also got some other stuff cooking with the books. And, you know, but I just want to say that, you know, coming up, I never thought I could be successful without being so confident and assured. And I'll tell you, I got to be a part of this 2012 World Series a couple years after, you know, this whole transformation. And I won these incredible games, but it was because I said, God, I don't even care about the success. I just want you, and I just want to do my best out there.
Wow.
And when I stopped holding on and for that redemption and hoping everyone would give me that redemption in San Francisco, finally I got it, you know, when I stopped worrying about it. And I just think God redeemed, you know, 7 years of a contract with two good games. And I just think that's just a testament to who he is.
Wow. What a perfect place to end. Barry Zito, the book once again is called Curveball: How I Discovered True Fulfillment After Chasing Fame and Fortune. Sir, it was a real treat to meet you today. Thank you so much for taking the time to be with us.
Awesome. Thanks so much, Ryan. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks for sharing in the story of this latest episode of Faith Radio's On the Road. For more on today's conversation and the full podcast archive of all our episodes, look for On the Road when you visit myfaithradio.com.
Thank you so much for listening. Programming like this is available through your support, and you can learn more about partnering financially at myfaithradio.com. We'd also love to hang out with you during the week on Facebook and on Twitter. Just search for On the Road with Ryan Thomas. Talk to you again soon.